What happens to your old passwords? Does free OneCloud kill online backup? Robert Herron talks quantum dots and Super Bowl TV picks, streaming games to your living room, and where is the RSS feed? All that and more coming up on Tech Thing. Tech Thing is brought to you by viewers like you. If you get value from the show and would like to support us directly, please consider contributing at patreon.com/techthing.
I'm Shannon Morse.
And I'm Patrick Norton.
And this is Tech Thing. We make technology behave.
And we try to have a little bit of fun doing it.
We do like tech, but we love what we can do with it, whether it's the latest in mobile phones or speeding up your gaming PC.
New apps or how to make sure your data, like that awesome photo, doesn't get away. We are here for you. Last week's episode, all about CES.
Yeah.
We're going to get our questions on this week.
Yes, we are. So first off, we wanted to start with Jeremy. He writes, "Hey Tech Thing crew, I never missed an episode of Techzilla, and I'm excited to see everyone back with a new show. Now that OneDrive is rolling out unlimited cloud storage for Office 365 subscribers and hopefully more services following suit, are dedicated cloud backup solutions still viable? I currently subscribe to Crash Plan to maintain a local and cloud backup. This no longer seems necessary when I can store everything in OneDrive, sync a copy to my computer, and backup the OneDrive folder to my NAS. This way I still have two backups of my data. Is it safe to drop my cloud backup subscription? Do dedicated cloud backup solutions offer any advantages over cloud storage solutions such as encryption, data loss protection, and if the service is hacked, will my data be kept safe? Keep up the great work. From Jeremy."
Hey, Jeremy.
Good question.
Yeah. First up, awesome to hear you've got your 3-2-1 on. Three copies on two different mediums, at least one of them offsite. That is a backup plan, especially if it's automated.
Yes.
So here's a couple things to think about. One, anybody can be hacked.
Anybody. Anyone.
Generally speaking, reputable vendor, encryption, they should be doing their work, and nothing bad should happen. But I've decided at this point, anybody can be hacked. I think you're probably a lot less likely to be hacked by a dedicated service that is going to make its life on keeping your data protected.
True.
But, Microsoft should be doing a pretty good job. I think they'll be doing a pretty good job. One thing to think about, offsite backup isn't always practical. Gigabytes, terabytes of data take forever to upload.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's a really good idea for critical info, even if it's a drive in a Ziploc bag and a Pelican case inside your safe deposit box, or if I have a hard drive stored at Robert's house so that if my house burns down, it doesn't go away.
I might have a big 2-terabyte drive just locked away in a safe upstairs where nobody can get to it except for me with a key or a lockpick.
Yeah, and I bring that up in the middle of a conversation about remote backup services, because sometimes if you have huge amounts of data, or if you're just in a place where your only option is satellite data, or if you have really cruddy upload speeds on your local ISP, it can be problematic. I personally think online backup will be forced to go unlimited slowly but surely across most of the vendors. Most folks will never use unlimited amounts, but as more and more players like Microsoft or Google make that happen, it's going to be difficult. As far as free unlimited OneDrive with Office 365, this is great if you're an Office 365 subscriber. I am probably never going to subscribe to Office 365, so I'm still going to need Crash Plan or some other service. Now, if you leave Office 365, remember, you're going to have to start paying for all that data, or you're going to have to migrate it to another service, or you're going to have to back it all up on a new service, which brings us back to taking months to upload your data. I think this is a great play for Microsoft to lock big and small companies or individual users like you into Office, which is a major cash cow. Me, outside of Google owning my email life, I'm not really into being locked down by anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. So no, I don't think it's going to kill off Crash Plan or anybody else, but it's definitely worth, you ask some great questions, looking at encryption, looking at your upload speed, thinking of how long it's going to take your data to upload. Take a look at these things. If Crash Plan allows you to back up all of your PCs in your house, can you still do that with OneDrive? If you only have one PC and it's linked to one OneDrive account with one Office 365 account, it's easy. Multiple accounts, multiple PCs, it may get a little more complicated.
I think you fully answered that.
Maybe to death.
Of course, if you have further questions about offsite backups or anything revolving around that, ask at techthing.com is the best way to get a hold of us. And I think it's time to throw it over to Hack 5 and see what's going on their side of the land.
What is going on over at Hack 5?
What's up, it's Darren. I don't know if you guys know, I do a show called Hack 5 with Shannon here, and we have been building some awesome stuff. Shannon's been learning a lot about building out circuitry with Arduinos, and this week she's learning about capacitors. I've got a whole bunch of cool stuff about drones, and so I just want to let you guys know about how you can use Linux scripts to download YouTube videos and all sorts of other cool stuff. So check it out over on the sister show, HAK5, hack5.org. Back to you guys.
We promised to get our favorite TV and home theater maven, Mr. Robert Herron, on to go a little deeper in the shiny screens we saw at CES. And ladies and gentlemen, look who's here.
Hey, hey.
Welcome to Tech Thing, man.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Okay.
Dive in. CES is over.
It's kind of funny. I think our Patreon audience is going to see like the 32-minute version of this conversation, but we're going to try to condense it down because CES was kind of all about extended dynamic range, OLED, and quantum dots.
Without a doubt.
Or I like to think is LG versus the rest of the the TV industry. We've given up on like TV, UHD, 4K. They're just back to being TVs again, right?
They are. No, everything's going to go 4K. Actually, right. Everything 55 inches and larger in within a couple of years will be a 4K display. That's just the way the industry's going.
Right.
High dynamic range, really what that's just saying is that the content makers and the people who make the TVs and the way they distribute it, they want to be able to put brighter details into the pictures that we look at today, into the video that we enjoy. Basically, instead of having super dark black or well contrasted, this is taking it to the next level where things like, you know, chrome or highlights in a video can really be punched up with extra brightness. And that requires both the content to be authored properly, as well as a display that can do it, and a way to get the two to meet.
So the getting the two to meet is going to be the point of the UHD Alliance.
That is the main goal, is just to make it all easier to handle, and there's a lot of people involved in that. Four manufacturers, a few of the content owners, as well as
Netflix.
People like, and DirecTV, they're all looking at, hey, we all want to be a part of this. And it's also to reduce the cost of doing it as well. Dolby and Technicolor are involved as well. And basically, it's for them to get together. They haven't even had one meeting yet.
Right.
So, but it is, the alliance has been formed, and they want to do it.
We intend to make this stuff work, because we're selling a lot of 4K screens, and Panasonic's kind of got a 4K ready Blu-ray player.
And this format allows for
4K Blu-ray ready Blu-ray player.
A few cool things, one being the high dynamic range, another being color that you mentioned.
And that's what we were showing just a second ago, because high dynamic range is not necessarily an expanded color palette.
Not at all. Two totally different things.
Mm-hmm.
HD video, Rec. 709 that we all know and love, is a relatively small part of the color chart that you saw right there. It's a small subset of it all, and the ability to expand that subset out to cover more of that, of all
in
color that is humanly possible to see, is the goal. And the next standard coming up that they currently use in digital cinema is called DCI.
Right.
And DCI requires a display that can accurately, and that's the key word, accurately be able to reproduce more saturated colors, deeper, darker reds, more brilliant greens, and in particular, and all the colors in between, really.
Right. And when we're looking at that shark fin, the entire shark fin is like all of the visible wavelengths our eyeballs can see.
Totally. D65 represents the white point where red, blue, and green mix together to form the standard white that they use in television today. And yes, the larger the triangle, the more
colors
you want. The triangles basically represent the mathematical models that the video is encoded with.
Mm-hmm.
That one kind of oblong shape, Poynter's gamut, is just a scientist who said, you know what, I'm going to actually do physical measurements of the real world in terms of how we perceive color. And that's what he came up with, roughly that meandering outline. So, but what that did, though, is give all the engineers, though, say, okay, we can come up with red, blue, green primaries that cover as much of that as possible in order to produce a standard that gives us a richer experience. However, you need a display that can keep up with it, and that's what the manufacturers are using, things like quantum dots and enhanced LEDs in order to produce this new color experience.
And don't forget OLED.
No, not at all. And if you love what LG's done already, they're bringing out a whole new array of OLEDs for this season, including a flat screen option and larger sizes up to about 77 inches.
So what is a quantum dot?
It's a semiconductor particle, a crystalline structure. And the way to visualize it is that they're stimulated with light currently. They shine blue LEDs on them. And the smaller the particle is, the more the color will skew toward blue in terms of what it fluoresces.
Mm-hmm.
The larger the particle, it skews toward red. If you can precisely control the size of that particle, you can make a very precise color output from it. So you can then take, say, a very efficient blue LED, combine that with red and green quantum dot materials, and to create that red, blue, green mix of that creates a white light that is then used to filter through the rest of the LCD panel.
So a blue backlight, a sheet of quantum dot material, yes, then all of the LCD that create my pixels.
Companies like 3M are right, already pumping out these sheets of material in literally a form that can replace one of the common parts in an LCD, the diffuser layer. So LCD manufacturers are like, really? All we have to do is pop the diffuser out, pop in your diffuser that's enhanced with the QD right, material, add the blue backlights, done. And you have basically an expanded color palette with really no other cost involved, which is what they love.
We're going to talk about expanded color palettes and the sort of videophile cineast experience, but we're going to start with one of the viewer questions we got. A tweet from @thequestion007, with plasma going away, what's the best tech for classic movies with 24 frames per second and natural blur?
I have to say, a good projector, mm-hmm, a three-chip projector in particular, because three-chip over a single-chip DLP, it gives you better color brightness, mm-hmm, and you get other benefits as well, but the color brightness is the big one for a three-chip system. And three-chip projectors, generally speaking, are all running at 120 hertz or faster. So that 120 hertz is a nice multiple of 24. So that 24 frames per second of cinema translates really well onto a screen that's running at a multiple of that, namely 120 hertz. Now for televisions, the 120 hertz LCDs or faster will also give you that multiple, especially if you can turn off the motion interpolation, right, the smoothing effect, you can get back to a very filmic look for the video that you're trying to enjoy.
Now, if I want the ultimate videophile experience and I'm weeping because plasma's going away and OLED and SUHD television from LG's OLEDs and Samsung's, exactly, SUHD aren't here yet, it doesn't really matter if I don't have a very dark room to watch my video in.
Yeah, in order to really show off the best TV technologies, mm-hmm, today, it requires a dark room environment. If you're dealing with a room with some light in it, you can get away with a lot more, and arguably, brightness of the TV itself overall, right, becomes a more important aspect. Screen size, too. I would take a larger screen.
Air to the what sounds like it's too large.
Always.
If you think you need a 42, get a 50. If you think you need a 50, get a 60. If you think you need a 65, get a 70 if you can afford it.
I do a quick measurement, right, of the width available, of the space I have, and the screen size should be at least that big. Or let's say like you got a 70-inch width, mm-hmm, get a 70-inch screen to put in that place. That, right, it will always fit. But
is it too early to buy 4K? I mean, okay, if you're a videophile and you have a darkened room and you want the ultimate experience, wait for the televisions that are coming later this year.
Totally. If you're a videophile, though, don't buy a cheap 4K TV, because,
right,
you're going to be disappointed with that in the end anyway. I would rather have a better picture experience at 1080p than to spend money or to spend the same money but have reduced picture quality, right, in a 4K display. Eventually, within the next 2 or 3 years, all screen sizes, 55 inches and larger, will just be a 4K display.
Got it.
That's just going to happen. It's the other stuff, the high dynamic range video and the expanded color palettes that are really going to make the difference. And then when you get into why certain TVs cost more than others, it gets into that dark room experience. Can it do a really dark, convincing black level? And then later on, we'll see, can it do those cool highlights for HDR video? Those are future-looking things. Or contrast never goes out of style, but at least for the HDR stuff.
So if I'm buying a TV for the Super Bowl, I'm in a bright room, and the lights are on or the windows are unshaded, just buy the brightest LED flat panel. LCD flat panel.
They're all LED backlit, right, now. So as far as your LCD panels, it's going to be that technology,
right,
that gets you the brightness you need. Some are now direct lit.
Right.
All of Vizio's current lineup of LCD TVs are actually direct lit with what they call local dimming, mm-hmm, that will dim the LEDs behind the screen, behind areas that don't need as much brightness,
right,
to give you a better black level. Other screens that are premium models will do that from edge lit systems and still be able to dim parts of the screen,
right,
to help boost the contrast. But overall, take a look at it in the store. If it's a shiny surface compared to a more matte surface, that might help with light control, mm-hmm, or minimizing reflections. Those are the things you really want to look out for. But really, screen size, brightness, and just a good setup overall.
Right. Unless you're a videophile, and we'll talk about that another time. @TrivialTravis tweets, what's your favorite over-the-air DVR viewing solution? I'm going to assume we mean digital video recorder there. Windows Media Center, Channel Master, TiVo?
I have a Windows Media Center PC at home that I, mm-hmm, run over-the-air tuners with. That's a little more complicated. The best single buy it, set it up, turn it on, and forget it system I've messed with so far is Channel Master's DVR Plus. It's a great thin product. You can either buy it without any storage at all, or they come preloaded if you want that built in. You don't want to even mess with that part. All you have to do is plug in an antenna, add an internet connection, which is even optional, but you really should add an internet connection for channel guide services. Mm-hmm. it's good to go. Dual tuner, that's the big deal there. That way you can record one channel while watching another. And they're constantly updating the product, which is something I like to see from any manufacturer. Right. They're adding new video streaming services, including live channels, which that'll be coming up in another month or so. They say later this month, we'll see. But I'm really curious to see what their channel lineup will be, and in addition to the already built-in streaming options like Netflix and other Pandora.
There's nothing sadder than a set-top box, or for that matter, a television with a built-in system that doesn't get any upgrades ever.
No.
Because they get useless really, really fast.
Shove it out the door and abandon it. Makes me sad.
It does make you sad. Heronfidelity.com, is that the website, ladies
Please,
and gentlemen?
Please, go visit. Enjoy my work.
And check out the favorite gear. There's some really, really good stuff there.
Thank you.
And if you click on the links on Robert's page here in Fidelity.com, he'll make money off of Amazon.com.
I provide stuff that I want to buy, though. Oh, also, I've got some picks for the Super Bowl coming up as well. So, Super Bowl.
HeronFidelity.com, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And keep an eye out for AVXL.com coming soon.
What are you talking about?
I don't know what I'm talking about. This episode of Tech Things brought to you by viewers like you. If you're enjoying the show, please consider donating to our Patreon at patreon.com/techthing. You can donate a nickel, a dime, or even $5 per episode, and that contribution goes directly back into show production. And remember, if you can't donate, no worries. We'd love it if you share the show with your friends, subscribe on YouTube, or just send us your questions on your favorite social network. Thank you so much for supporting the show.
We're back and it's time for a rapid fire round. So this is where we're gonna try to answer three different questions, give three recommendations, or review three different products in less than a minute each. Are you ready?
Go!
Go!
Oh boy. This week's questions are all about the new show. Question one from the entire internet. Will Tech Thing be available via iTunes, RSS, Downcast, Downcoast, Roku, Pocket Cast, etc.?
Everything.
Yes.
Yes, it will. So we will have the show available to download as soon as we hit our Patreon goal for RSS feeds. Now, we want to give you access to quality, fast downloads, and it does take a little bit more work to make those feeds happen.
And money.
And money.
Bandwidth costs money.
That is why we made it a goal. Yeah, we could just do archive.org, but it would be a little slow
Well,
for some people.
That's a whole other conversation. $132.20.
We are so close.
No, $122.20.
And we can also count.
Question two is from at OEW55R on Twitter. Will you have a post office box for people to mail donations to Tech Thing? Many people are skittish giving credit card numbers online. I am.
Yeah, we do Hack 5. I totally understand you. Yes, we will have a PayPal donation button on our site over at techthing.com. That's T-E-K-thing.com. Mm-hmm. And you can also donate via this address, which is 15501 San Pablo Avenue, number G325, Richmond, California, 94806. And that's also where you can send us strange things, except not strange things.
No dead animals in a box. It's a good place to send if you have product information to send us.
Yes.
Just send it to Attention Tech Thing or to Attention Shannon or to Attention Patrick.
Yep.
And you can send snacks also.
Snacks.
Question three is an email from Alan. I supported you on Patreon, but I wasn't sure how often you were planning to do episodes, so I capped my pledge monthly. Smart goal. How often do you plan to do episodes? Twice a week? Not sure why I thought of that. Thanks for continuing the tech news, reviews, and advice. Your show is unique. Thanks to the knowledge and enthusiasm of both you guys.
Aw.
Thank you.
We are planning to release an episode once per week.
Yes.
Just once.
Yes.
If it was any more than that, I would die. We will also be releasing other extra stuff to our Patreons themselves.
That stuff's free, though.
Yeah, that stuff is going to be free. So any like behind-the-scenes type of things, like thank you videos, behind-the-scenes pictures.
The 22-minute interview I did with Robert earlier.
Like that. So anything like that you can find over on the Patreon if you become one of the patrons.
Yeah.
But yeah, just once a week. So you're good.
We are on the Twitters. Twitter.com/techthing or at techthing. We are on YouTube, youtube.com/c/techthing. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/techthing. We love your questions. Bring them to us and we'll try to answer them.
Yep.
We'll be right back. Great question from Sean. He wants to know what happens to old passwords on old websites. He writes in, I use LastPass. In the past, I used Chrome to remember my passwords. So LastPass has all of my ancient passwords. I used to use the same password in lots of places. Not good. I went looking for some of the sites that LastPass says I have the same password for, and a lot of them are gone. Is my data safe? Is there anything I can do aside from eliminating my old passwords from my other sites? What happens when a forum site dies? Ooh. Good luck on the new show. I can't wait to see what happens. Sean.
Ooh.
Well, in theory, right, somebody could like save all of the forums from their website and just browse them at night, searching through manually, but generally speaking,
that's not going to happen. So when a website is gone and you used a password on that website that could potentially be vulnerable, what do you do? Well, first of all, you're on the right path. Yeah. So Sean, good job using a password manager. That's an excellent first step. Make sure that you change the password for any of the sites that were the same as that first one
Absolutely.
That you discovered has disappeared. If it is vulnerable, you need to make sure that a bad guy can't get into any other sites with the same credentials, or else you're going to be in a world of sadness and hate and boo-boos. So next off, if the site is actually gone for good, you can try Googling it, or you could look it up in your bookmarks if you have really, really old bookmarks. Maybe there might be a new redirect for the site. It might have changed from a .org to a .eu or something like that. So you can look around Google Bing, all those different search places, and see if it's still around somewhere.
Right.
Because it potentially could. Once you can access it, if you can, you want to change that password as well, because you don't know how they are saving their passwords. The next thing about any website is where you use your password, you don't know how they are actually storing that password on their servers.
And that's why Shannon and Darren and anybody else who talks about security wants you to have an individual, different, secure password for
exactly.
every different site, which is why you are now running a program like LastPass or KeePass if you're running KeePass. Because if server A's boxes get compromised, you don't want that to give somebody the opportunity. Because what they're going to do is they're going to be like, you know, I'm going to run this name or this email and this password against every other website on the planet I have access to.
Yeah, exactly. Yay, rainbow tables. So, yeah, A, was it compromised? You don't know. When the site went down, did they auction it off to some fancy server company, to some other company somewhere?
Or some guy named Bob.
Did they? Yeah, did they auction it off to a dude named Bob who was like, sweet, eBay, yes, this is my server now. Or did they wipe the server before auctioning it off if they actually did sell it? You don't know any of this stuff because they don't really tell you on the internet. It's a company that's gone. So how did they encrypt the passwords if they actually did encrypt them whenever you were using their site? How do they do the encryption in the first place? All of these different questions factor into your security when you store passwords on any kind of site anywhere on the internet. So it's always really, really important, always important, to use a different password on each and every site that you use. Because even if their website says that their passwords are secure, you know, true, SSL, secure, blah, 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 we hash everything. Trust no one. They could be lying.
Or they could have made a mistake.
Or they could.
Or it could turn out to have a massive vulnerability in the system that you don't know about.
Yes. Trust no one when it comes to those guys.
Use a different password for every account.
This is why I, too, use LastPass, but there's also KeePass and OnePass that you can use as well. They all work very similar to each other.
They're all pretty awesome.
Yes, they are.
Yes.
So I hope that answered your question. Thank you, Sean.
We got a bunch of comments on youtube.com/c/techthings on our first episode. We want to thank all of you for commenting. I wanted to address this one from Orion's Angel specifically. It says, the Razer Forge TV can stream high-end PC games. For example, your Steam games to the living room, that's the big selling point. Way to not even mention that, guys. You can't use the Amazon Fire TV to do that. I really wish these tech snobs would do more research before they put down a device.
Ah, ouch!
Okay, so oddly enough, I think we got to spend about 15 or 20 minutes in the Razer booth with one of the
They
Razer
had one
people.
Set up, and they had a couch where you could actually play on one of the consoles, so
and
it was pretty cool.
Oddly enough, Razer never actually mentioned streaming PC games to the Forge TV while
Correct.
We were there. So this is the Forge TV. We didn't get too deep talking about it yesterday. But yeah, from what we're reading, if you have the Razer Cortex Stream, which will go into beta Q2 this year, it'll do 1080p 60Hz wireless streaming to the Forge TV, if you download and install the app. The app is going to be free with the $150 Razer Forge TV Servo Controller Bundle, or the $80 Razer Servo Controller if you buy it standalone, or the $120 Razer Turret Lap Board, which is a really cool keyboard that folds out with space for a magnetic mouse. I actually really
think
that's
one of your favorites.
I want to buy that, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
If you just want to buy and download the app standalone, it's going to be like $40. You'll be able to stream PC games.
Specifically for streaming.
Yeah. And we understand any PC game, DX9 or higher, to the Forge TV, and apparently in the future it'll stream to other Android TV boxes, possibly for a subscription fee. That part's been a little vague.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. But I gotta say, it was free to connect my gaming PC to the HDMI port, to an open HDMI port on my AV receiver. I'm just saying, that won't work for everybody, but wireless HDMI is an option too. But if you do wireless HDMI, you don't get all of the coolness of the Android gaming.
Very true. Now, so, is it expensive to use an AVR?
Well, it's kind of funny. For some reason, Orion's Angel thinks AVRs cost $1,000, and AVR is an AV receiver. If you have speakers and a box that sends audio to the speakers, chances are you have HDMI ports on the back of that. But your gaming PC may be nowhere near your living room, and that's where things like the Razer TV or NVIDIA streaming system or some of the other stuff we've seen gets really, really interesting.
Gotcha.
I'm just saying.
Cool. Thanks for the clarification, sir. All right, our next one comes from Twitter. It's from at nerd1701. He said, check out this article on a high-performance FreeNAS build. Pretty cool.
Yeah, so Pivotal Labs put this together. It's a high-performing mid-range NAS server. I thought it was really interesting because we did some, Michael Hand and I did some FreeNAS builds on Dytrion back in the day. But this is really interesting because it's like 16.6 terabytes of usable storage. They're running like 16 cents a gigabyte. But they did it around an Atom processor, which I thought was really interesting.
Wow.
And, you know, they're running like 16 gigabytes of RAM inside this machine, which if you want to do all the cool ZFS stuff inside of FreeNAS, you need mad amounts of RAM. Not ECC RAM, so I'm sure these guys got roasted for that because there's a bunch of people in the FreeNAS community that are like, if you're not ECC, your data's going to die and you're going to basically be in hell. But that's whole nother conversation I don't want to get into. And like we said earlier in the show, 3, 2, 1.
Yes.
RAID is not a backup. RAID is part of a backup solution. Although I try to never say solution, because solution seems to be a marketing term in the 21st century. So
we should do a whole segment about RAID.
So many segments we could do about RAID.
Yeah.
Contact us if you want us to talk about RAID.
And from the That's Pretty, It's So Super Shiny department, this one is from at Horwitz, who said, probably the coolest neo-retro Apple product design that I've ever seen. That thing is beautiful and so pretty.
I'm not sure how I found that tweet, but it's really crazy. This company called this company magazine, it's a German magazine or a German website, they came up with an idea for a MacBook that was essentially built out of tablet components, I want to say. It's in German. My German sucks, but as you scroll farther and farther down, you find the English version.
Facelift for the Macintosh. I'm assuming that's what that means.
Well, they're basically saying, like, their idea was that it's a MacBook Air, sort of an 11-inch MacBook Air screen. It's a touch screen. They're doing SSD, you know, Core i7 CPU. But if I'm not mistaken, this is kind of 3D rendering. This is their idea, their vision, not an actual Apple product leaked or otherwise. Because I saw this and I immediately went to Apple.com and I'm like, oh, okay. I think this was their idea, not an actual project. I think it's a pretty cool homage to the original classic design, though. I'm just saying.
All right, that wraps up this episode of Tech Thing. We hope that you guys liked it. If you didn't, or if you have any questions or comments or feedback, or if you, in fact, love this episode, email us, ask@techthing.com, and follow us over on the YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/c/techthing.
Don't forget to back that stuff up, and remember, once in a while, put down the phone, step away from the screen, close the laptop, and do something analog, like go to a shelter and walk a dog or socialize. Aww. The kitties.
A dog farm.
A dog farm.
Interesting. Are they free-range dogs? I'm Shannon Morris.
I'm Patrick Norton.
We'll see you next time on Tech Thing.
The problem with thinking is it gets in the way of reading. And we're going to talk Screaming games to your living room.
I'm Shannon Morse.
And I'm Patrick Norton.
And this is Tech Thing.
Bust. Sorry.
Did you see that? You messed me up.
Yeah, I did. Because you know what? We did like 588 episodes of the last show that's slightly different.
And this is Techzilla.
We're going to keep it simple for the first one.
You can just be like, thank you, Darren. And then back to us.
Are you guys?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. That's sweet and wholesome. Sweet, wholesome, wholesome, sweet. No. Sweet, wholesome, wholesome, sweet. Sweet, wholesome, wholesome, sweet. This is hard. This is just beautiful.
That was my dolphin noise.
I noticed.